conflicting affects, and we'll look at that in several different iterations. So let's move right to an example that will illustrate this. Oh, I should tell you about Walter Wink first. Any of the theological ones here know about Walter Wink? Good. Know about him, okay. Well, Wink.
W-I-N-K?
Yeah, he's a theologian from the 70s, 80s. And his interesting idea is that what I'd call the self-care system is not just an intrapsychic thing. Wink wants to tell us that the powers have always existed. It's like they're in the atmosphere. And have always threatened the establishment of democratic human communities throughout history. He makes clear, for example, that the elemental powers were especially menacing to the early Christian communities as they tried to establish small centers of worship around the Middle East. The Apostle Paul, for example, wrote the following warning to the Ephesians, quote, "For we are not contending against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, arches, against the powers, exousias, against the world rulers, cosmokratoros, of this present darkness, against the spiritual hosts, pneumatica, of wickedness in the heavenly places." Wink's writings are useful for my purposes in this essay because he makes clear that the elemental powers are beyond personal. They are archetypal, spiritual, cosmic, and they find their way into social and institutional life. In other words, they exist in the culture all around us, and while invisible, they have profound unseen impact. In a very telling description, Wink says, "Every institution has its angel." That is its own unique spirit, and this spirit is every bit as important as the physical, historical, economic, or social aspects of institutions. If someone violates this spirit, though he keeps all the laws and precepts of the system will condemn him. Conversely, if someone submits to this spirituality, he will be able to live in spite of violating all its laws and flouting all its institutions. I think this statement is relevant to the dark spirit that has moved into our American national psyche. A dark spirit which Donald Trump is only the most conspicuous avatar. Before the 2016 election at a campaign stop in Sioux City, Iowa, Trump said, quote, "The polls, you know, they say I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's that incredible." Trump is recognizing here the dark spiritual wave he is riding and the fact that his base is mesmerized by its angel. It has become painfully clear in the first 2 years of his presidency. Once this spirituality is in place, Trump continues to live in spite of violating all the nation's laws and flouting all of its institutions. And no one seems to understand how he gets away with it. He, like all the rest of us, is living inside a pathology, riding the dark spiritual energy that infuses a dissociative psychology with its violence, contempt, corruption, and its illusion of American innocence and magical greatness in the center. Okay, now I want to look at a couple of examples from our national life of men who were possessed by hatred from their dark angels and how they processed it. The first is Dwight Eisenhower, who was one of five boys raised by Ida and David Eisenhower in relative poverty in Abilene, Texas. David, Ike's father, was a rigid man and strict disciplinarian, while Ida had a warm, vibrant personality. Dwight would later call her the finest person he had ever known. This account comes from David Brooks's book on the search for character or the quest for character. One of the things Ida did for Dwight was to help him with his hatred. Like Donald Trump, Ike had an innately aggressive, rebellious disposition that he would have to temper and discipline all his life to become the great general and later president that he was. Here is the story. One Halloween evening, was 10, Eisenhower's older brothers received permission to go out trick-or-treating, a more adventurous activity in those days than it is now. Ike wanted to go with him, but his parents told him that he was too young. He pleaded with them, watched his brothers go, and then became engulfed in uncontrollable rage. He turned red, his hair bristled. Weeping and screaming, he rushed out into the front yard and began pounding his fists against the trunk of an apple tree, scraping the skin off and leaving his hands bloody and torn. His father came out, shook him, lashed him with a hickory switch, sent him up to bed. After about an hour, with Ike sobbing in his pillow, his mother came up, sat silently, rocking in the chair next to his bed. Eventually, she quoted a verse from the Bible. He that conquereth his own soul is greater than he who taketh a city. As she began to salve and bandage his wounds, Ida Eisenhower told her son to beware of the hot anger and hatred that burned inside. Hatred is a futile thing, she told him, which only injures the person who harbors it. Of all her boys, she told him, he had the most to learn about controlling his considerable passions and talents. Much later, when he was 76, Eisenhower wrote, quote, I have always looked back on that conversation as one of the most valuable moments of my life. His mother had never shamed him, and it helped him hold his raging conflict in a compassionate and loving way. At the end of the conversation, Eisenhower was reconciled, and he fell off peacefully to sleep. In this case, young Eisenhower's avenging angel erupted in rage, but was later held in a loving relationship and transformed into both inner conflict. He said to his mother, I know I was wrong to do that. Inner conflict and usable anger, eventually even gratitude. A person who has accomplished this can witness and accept his own personal complicity with evil, his own episodic identification with the dark angel and its raging tantrums, and take responsibility for the harm he has done or would like to do. Such a person can be in conflict with himself, can eventually see both sides of an issue without being triggered into defensive rage again. This in turn leads to an enhanced capacity for empathy with others, a growing moral center, very important, deeper friendships, greater resilience in the face of life's inevitable hurts, disappointments, and limitations. These hard-won achievements of a conflict psychology and an inner democracy lead further to a quickening of the human soul and a grasp of what we might call the tragic nature of human life. By the tragic nature of human life, I'm thinking about Heinz Kohut's sympathetic portrayal of tragic man as distinguished from Freud's guilty man and Jung's heroic man. For Kohut, the mature individual has gone beyond the conflict between his instinctual demands of the angels and the prohibitions of civilizations to a larger, more existential conflict between our childlike aspirations and their innocent hopes on the one hand, and our poignant, sad awareness of the limitations imposed by the privations and misfortunes that we all come into contact with, our own mortality and death. This leads for Kohut not to sadness, pessimism, or despair, but rather to the deep joy that attends our capacity to integrate the tragic aspects of life and accept ourselves, along with others, as, quote, transient participants in the ongoing stream of life. We embrace what William Wordsworth described in Tintern Abbey as the universally human and profoundly beautiful, still, sad music of humanity. Dwight Eisenhower was lucky to have had the kind of compassionate containment that his mother provided him on this occasion, and probably on many others. It gave him choices about how much of his rage and anger to unleash on the world later. He became one of the most effective generals in all of history, directing massive amounts of aggression against the Nazi enemy in the European theater. But his aggressive use of this power was no longer motivated by primitive hatred or identification with his avenging angel. He had mastered and neutralized his high-voltage hatred and converted it into anger he could talk about and use. He had wrestled with his dark angel, like Jacob did at the river Jabbok, and received its blessing. It was he who warned us later of the terrible dangers of the military-industrial complex. It was different with Donald Trump. One of Trump's moments of rage was captured by a PBS Frontline documentary called The Choice, maybe you've seen it, about Trump's life. The full episode can be found on PBS Frontline, and its minutes is, what I'm going to quote you is from minute 57 and forward. Here's a partial transcript. Trump had hit it big with Trump Tower. At 40, he claimed to be a billionaire. He was determined to make Trump a household name. By the late 80s, his ambition pushed him into uncharted territory, presidential politics. He liked the publicity. He liked the notoriety, and he began to insert himself into controversial issues, like the New York City Central Park jogger case. It was the ages of the accused, ages 14 to 17, and the horror of their alleged crime that caused a furor. A woman jogging in New York Central Park, raped and nearly beaten to death. What happened in Central Park was a violation to Trump. He felt it keenly and had a deep emotional reaction to it, and so he lashed out. He took out a full-page ad in the Times, "Bring back the death penalty. Bring back our police." He said the black suspects, five of them, who allegedly did this, should be executed. He said they were beasts. He said they were animals. And then he said, "You better believe that I hate the people who took this girl and raped her brutally. You better believe it. And it's more than anger. It's hatred. And I want society to hate them." The commentator continues, "The unstated text of this was that because there were five black kids who brutalized a white woman in Central Park, and everybody was outraged about it, and they are different from us, so we need to treat them with the severest methods possible. These five young men spent years in prison, but were later exonerated when the late actual rapist admitted his guilt." But Donald Trump never apologized. He didn't want to admit he was wrong. And to this day, he has not apologized for this statement or any others that he has made that have been so intemperate. But for Trump, his television rage had worked. His celebrity was bigger than ever, and talk of President Trump had begun. This is in the 80s. To me, this television documentary is a good illustration of the co-presence of innocence and violence in the psyche of Donald Trump. The invisible child in the system and its protective and persecutory angels, especially the violent one known as Dis. Some part of Donald Trump was unconsciously identified with the violated young girl's innocence. He himself was brutally treated by his father, and he was brutally picked on when he was at military school. He himself felt violated. We don't begrudge him this reaction, his outrage about the crime that violated an innocent girl, but notice what happened next. Trump wasn't satisfied with expressing his feelings and leaving the rest to law enforcement. He was filled with ultra-human passion, inflated rage, hatred off the spectrum of potentially constructive aggression, identified with his avenging angel. He needed to act on these feelings in order to discharge them. That's the nature of archetypal affects. We need to act on them because they're too much to hold. This is characteristic of a dissociative psychology. Conflict is avoided. We get the anger out. To promote this discharge, Trump vilified the black youths that were suspects in the case, calling them beasts and animals, destroying in his mind any innocent humanity that they may have possessed, reducing them to totalistic categories of evil, thereby justifying more hatred, demanding their deaths. Can you imagine what would have happened if he had been in a position to execute these five men, like he recommended, and they were then exonerated later? The rage in the black community? It's frightening, isn't it, to realize how much of U.S. foreign policy has been based on such binary thinking, vilification. vilification and precipitous action in defense of innocence. George Bush made Saddam Hussein into an evil man in his mind, claiming he was about to use weapons of mass destruction against innocent people. And this justified a shock and awe bombing campaign in which tens of thousands of actual innocent people were murdered. When it was discovered that there were no such weapons, well, oops, sorry, but there was no acknowledgement, no apology, no genuine regret. And we wonder why extremists in the Muslim world hate us and blow up our buildings. Hateful action from one dissociative psychology breeds more hateful action from another. The result is a vicious cycle that we know as the retributive justice cycle, leading from one violent action to another ad infinitum. There is no room for a struggle with avenging angels, no taming of the powers in this madness. So the retributive justice cycle, how to break it, some of our greatest social justice leaders, Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, have recommended nonviolent resistance in an effort to break this cycle. Such nonviolent resistance is in the democratic tradition of the New Testament prophet, Jesus Christ, who said, simply let your yes be a yes and your no a no. Anything more comes from the evil one. Isn't that amazing? That's Matthew 5:37. In the discipline of nonviolence, a conflict must be taken in, not acted out. This is a form of suffering and a sacrifice. It's a sacrifice required by a democracy of the psyche. Anything more comes from the evil one, says Jesus, from the avenging angel, from dis. In part one of Goethe's Faust, the poet laments, alas, two souls dwell within my breast. This is the ultimate lament of a conflict psychology, an inner democracy. We are divided within ourselves. We love and we hate, angelically. And we have a core of innocence and divine entitlement that paradoxically justifies either love or hate, but not the two in conflict with each other. So we need to be constantly reminded, simply let your yes be a yes and your no a no. Don't get tangled up. Anything else comes from the evil one. Okay. Now, we go to 11:45. Is that it?
Okay. We go to 10:45.
10:45?
Yes.
We have a half hour. Okay. Okay. In this part of my essay, I detail how I think we are all, as American people, and indeed as people on the face of the planet at this time in history, traumatized by reality. We are traumatized by a reality that we cannot metabolize and fully take in. We require dissociative defenses to survive in this world. If we really let in what we're doing to the planet, we'd be in despair. We can't take it all in. And also, we need to get active in whatever way we can to avoid this despair. So it's really, it's not just the climate change issues, it's the realities that are all around us.